Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome back to the program or podcast that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. We come to you every day from Washington on the Voice of America. Here's how it works. First, listen to the program and then download it and save it to a computer. That way you can go back and listen over and over again. You know that we always speak slowly, and we use words that are easy to understand. That is why these English lessons are so popular around the world. Today, we can practice English with two stories about science. The first is about rainwater use in Sri Lanka. Then, some agricultural news from the United States. That also has rainwater as a part of the story. Let's get ready to listen and learn with VOA. Here is part one. Sri Lanka plans to store and use 1 billion cubic meters of rainwater each year to support irrigation and power generation. The rainwater would go into the sea if it is not used. Sri Lanka is building the new water management system in its dry zone. The area covers the northern and eastern parts of the country. It is home to about one-third of Sri Lanka's 20 million people. But the land is mainly used for agriculture. Jonathan Evans has more on the story.
Climate change has severely hurt the area in the past 10 years. The region is also suffering a severe water crisis. Experts say the project could use enough water to fill two of the country's largest reservoirs, Victoria and Rondonagala. The government and donors are paying for the $675 million project. Work begins this month and should be completed by December 2024. The plan is one of the nation's largest water-related projects in the past years. It includes the construction of two new reservoirs and 260 kilometers of new canals linking existing reservoirs. The aim is to help the dry zone better control its water supply for power generation and farming. S. Shanmuga Sivanathan is a top official with the Department of Irrigation. He said that rain patterns have been changing and the dry zone is getting less water now. He said Sri Lanka needs to make the most of the water usage. The country's rainfall is 2,000 millimeters per year. Less than half falls in the dry zone. Most of the farming there depends on irrigation. Small water tanks hold water from the region's large reservoirs. Mr. Shanmuga Sivanathan said the dry zone faces the extremes of floods and drought as the rain patterns have changed. But he said there is no system in place to capture floodwaters, so drought can happen even in years of floods. A water infrastructure project for the dry zone has been in Sri Lankan plans since the 1970s. The Mahaweli Development Program included such ideas for the country's central hills and some of the north. The idea was to use the waters of the Mahaweli River, the longest in the country, to increase power generation capacity by about 260 megawatts. It was also designed to provide irrigation water to an additional 131,500 hectares of land. But civil war delayed the project for 25 years until 2009. Sri Lankan and Asian Development Bank officials said the new water management project is based on the Mahaweli plans. The ADB is providing $453 million in funding. The international lender also estimates that 70% of the dry zone's population depends on agriculture. The average yearly earnings of the people there is 10% lower than in other parts of the country. Lance Gore is a water resources expert with the ADB in the Philippine capital, Manila. He said the organization hopes that the new project will help end poverty in the area. The water expert said more water will increase the earning level of people dependent on agriculture. It also aims to supply safe drinking water to 350,000 people. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. If you like fresh fruits and vegetables, you would think the best time to pick them would be whenever they are ripe, right? Not necessarily, say some American agriculture experts, as Marcia James reports.
American researchers say farmers should wait one day after rainstorm or watering their fields to harvest fresh fruits and vegetables. They say gathering the crops at least 24 hours after rainfall increases food safety. They say it also may be enough to protect those eating from fresh produce from food-borne illnesses. Listeria is a food-borne bacteria. It grows best in wet conditions. Poisoning with Listeria monocytogenes can cause muscle pain. The person can also feel sick to the stomach and even experience diarrhea, the uncontrolled expulsion of waste from the body. Listeria can be a serious health threat for pregnant women and older adults. It can also threaten people with weak immune systems, like those with HIV, the virus responsible for the disease AIDS. The bacterium is everywhere in the environment, but usually grows in water. So crops that are harvested shortly after they have been watered are likely to contain unsafe levels of disease-causing listeria. Martin Weedman teaches food safety at Cornell University in New York State. He and other researchers are urging farmers to wait 24 hours after a rainfall or watering fields before they harvest crops. By waiting, he says, a field has enough time to dry out.
You're more likely to find listeria for a very short time. After one day, it drops back more or less to the baseline normal level that we find. So we found an effect of water, but it was very sort of short-lived, as that within a day, you're back to normal.
The findings were reported in the Journal Applied and Environmental Microbiology. In crops like spinach, listeria levels were 25 times greater when harvested immediately after the plants were watered. Martin Weedman says the bacterium can also be found in sandwich meat, especially when the meat is not kept to -4 or -5 degrees Celsius. He says there are a number of other settings where unsafe levels of listeria can hide.
And so it's important to have the tools in place to control this organism everywhere from, you know, primary production to food processing plants to retail to also helping consumers make the smart decisions what foods to eat and how to cook foods.
Martin Weedman notes that listeria poisoning is less common in developing countries. In such areas, he adds, foods generally are not left in iceboxes or refrigeration equipment, another source of bacterial overgrowth. I'm Marcia James.
News from the world of business and economics is next, and the story of America on the making of a nation. This is VOA.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The last 2 months have been difficult for investors in China's stock market. Major stock indexes, measures that track share values, all had big decreases during the month. This has many people questioning what China's stock market problems mean for its economy and the world. On July 27th, the Shanghai Composite Index dropped more than 8% in value, its largest single-day drop in 8 years. In recent weeks, prices dropped, although the government put a number of measures in place to keep prices from falling too far. These included lending billions of dollars to stock trading companies, having pension funds increase stock holdings, and threatening short sellers with legal action. Short sellers make a profit by trading stocks that are decreasing in price. The state China Securities Financial Corporation on Tuesday said it will continue to buy stocks to stabilize the market. The People's Bank of China also said it would place over $8 billion into money market funds, which are considered safe debt investments. Companies have also canceled plans to sell new shares on exchanges, and at one point, more than 1,400 companies requested that trading in their shares be halted. However, China's stock market is not closely connected to its economy. The Associated Press recently reported on a study by the Southwestern University of Finance in Chengdu, China. It said only 8.8% of households in China are involved in the market. That is much lower than the 30% of households in the U.S. with investments in the market. Many of the companies listed on Chinese markets are state-owned companies. Investors react to changes in government regulations and to availability of financing for trading. This can mean that share prices do not follow the economic performance of the companies that issue them. In the 12 months before June, China's stock market measures gained about 150%. At the same time, China reported lower economic growth during the same period. China's share price drop has had a limited effect on stock exchanges around the world. Stock indexes in Europe and Asia have had decreases in July. But China limits the number of stocks that foreign investors can buy through a link called the Shanghai-Hong Kong Stock Connection. In the case of China, that means money from foreign investors cannot easily flow in or out. Some experts say recent losses could be a sign that Chinese investors are worried that the government plans to reduce its support for the market. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we tell the story of a clash of cultures and beliefs. We look at the early history of relations between European settlers in North America and the native groups that had lived there for thousands of years before their arrival. The settlers arrived on the east coast of North America. Along the east coast, there were many different Indian tribes. They spoke many different languages. Some raised crops. Some were hunters. Some were often at war. Others were peaceful. Many of these tribes still exist. Indian nations like the Seneca, the Mohawk, the Seminole, and the Cherokee. Indian tribes shared a highly developed system of trade. They traded goods over a wide area. The first recorded meetings between Europeans and the Indians of the East Coast took place in the 1500s. Fishermen from France and the Basque area of Spain crossed the Atlantic Ocean. They hunted for whales along the east coast of North America. They set up camps and often traded with the local Indians. The Europeans often paid Indians to work for them. Both groups found this relationship to be successful. On several occasions, different groups of fishermen tried to establish a permanent settlement on the coast. The severe winters, however, made it impossible, so the camps were only temporary. The first permanent European settlers in New England began arriving in 1620. They wanted to live in peace with the Indians. They needed to trade with them for food. The settlers also knew that because they were so few in number, a battle with the Indians would result in their own quick defeat. Yet, problems began almost immediately. Perhaps the most serious was the difference in the way that the Indians and the Europeans thought about land. This difference created problems that would not be solved during the next several hundred years. Owning land was extremely important to the European settlers. In England and most other countries, land meant wealth. Owning large amounts of land meant that a person had great wealth and political power. Many of the settlers who came to North America could never have owned land back home in Europe. They were too poor, and they belonged to religious minorities. When they arrived in the New World, they discovered that no one seemed to own the huge amounts of land. Companies in England needed to find people willing to settle in North America. So they offered land to anyone who would take the chance of crossing the Atlantic. For many, it was a dream come true. It was a way to improve their lives. The land gave the European settlers a chance to become wealthy and powerful.
On the other hand, the Indians believed that no one could own land. They believed, however, that anyone could use it. Anyone who wanted to live on a piece of land and grow crops could do so. The American Indians lived with nature. They understood the land and the environment. They did not try to change it. They might grow crops in an area for a few years. Then they would move on. They would allow the land on which they had farmed to become wild again. They might hunt on one area of land for some time, but again they would move on. They hunted only what they could eat, so populations of animals could continue to increase. The Indians understood nature and were at peace with it. The first Europeans to settle in the New England area of the Northeast wanted land. The Indians did not fear them. There were not many settlers, and there was enough land for everyone to use and plant crops. It was easy to live together. The Indians helped the settlers by teaching them how to plant crops and survive on the land. But the Indians did not understand that the settlers were going to keep the land. This idea was foreign to the Indians. To them, it was like trying to own the air or the clouds. As the years passed, more and more settlers arrived and took more and more land. They cut down trees. They built fences to keep people and animals out. They demanded that the Indians stay off their land. Another problem between the settlers and the Indians involved religion. The settlers in New England thought Christianity was the one true faith, and that all people should believe in it. They soon learned that the Indians were satisfied with their own spiritual beliefs and were not interested in changing them. As a result, many settlers came to believe that the Native Americans could not be trusted because they were not Christians. They began to fear the Indians and think of them as evil. The European settlers failed to understand that the Indians were an extremely spiritual people with a strong belief in unseen powers. The Indians lived very close to nature. They believed that all things in the universe depend on each other. All native tribes had ceremonies that honored a creator of nature. They recognized the creator's work in their everyday lives. Other events also led to serious problems between the Native Americans and the newcomers. One problem was disease. For example, some of the settlers carried the bacteria that caused smallpox, although they themselves did not get sick. Smallpox had caused deadly epidemics in Europe, but it was unknown to the Indians. Their immune systems had developed no protection against the disease. It killed whole tribes, and smallpox was only one disease brought from Europe. There were others that also infected the Indians. The first meetings between settlers and Native Americans would follow the same course in almost every European settlement along the East Coast. The two groups would meet as friends. They would begin by trading for food and other goods. In time, however, something would happen to cause a crisis. Perhaps a settler would demand that an Indian stay off the settler's land. Perhaps someone was killed. Fear would replace friendship. One side or the other would react to what they believed was an attack. A good example of this was the conflict known as King Philip's War. Metacom, also known as Metacomet, was a leader of the Wampanoag tribe. He was the son of Chief Massasoit. Without the help of Massasoit and his tribe, the first European settlers in the northernmost colonies might not have survived their first winter. The Wampanoag Indians provided them with food. They taught the settlers how to plant corn and other crops. The two groups were very friendly for several years. Massasoit and his court attended the first harvest feast, which became known as Thanksgiving. As the years passed, however, fear and mistrust replaced friendliness. Metacom's brother died of a European disease. Metacom, who was known to the English as King Philip, blamed the colonists. He also saw how the increasing numbers of settlers were changing the land. He believed they were destroying it. One small crisis after another finally led to the killing of a Christian Indian who lived with the settlers. The settlers retaliated by killing three Indians. King Philip's War quickly followed. It began in 1675 and continued for almost 2 years. Men, women, and children on both sides were killed. Historians say as many as 3,000 Native Americans died in the violence. More than 600 settlers are believed to have been killed. Historians say the tribe of Indians called the Narragansett were innocent victims of King Philip's War. The Narragansett were not involved in the war. They did not support one group or the other. However, the settlers had come to fear all Indians and killed almost all the members of the Narragansett tribe. This fear and the failure to compromise were not unusual. They would strongly influence relations between the European settlers and the American Indians in all areas of the new country. These clashes of cultures would continue as more and more Europeans arrived. The Puritans from England landed in Massachusetts. The Dutch settled what would become New York State, and the Quakers, unwelcome in England, settled in Pennsylvania. That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History, in VOA Special English.